We have a full house here in the Political Rewind studio, and we need it because there is so much to discuss today. It's Wednesday, which means that Greg Bluestein, a political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joins us. Thanks. You were on vacation last week, so we're glad to have you back.
We went to sunny Charlotte, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, okay. So for our listeners in Charlotte, they can write you directly, not to us.
We did have a blast. The kids are still getting over it.
Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul is with us again. It's great to have you back, Rusty.
Good to always be here.
You're up for re-election in November.
November, yep.
Probably happy at this moment that the election of the Sandy Springs mayor is a nonpartisan race.
You don't want to be running under
a party label right about now.
Though I think my identification is fairly well branded on my forehead. So
I think that's right. Rusty is a past chair of the Georgia Republican Party, and he worked for a very long time for Jack Kemp when he was at Housing and Urban Development Secretary, and then on his presidential campaign. You and I in 1987.
Yep.
Went out for the announcement tour with Jack Kemp.
Yep.
Flew all over the Northeast. It was a wonderful couple of days.
Great days when politics was really fun.
That's exactly right.
Oh, come on. It's still fun.
Lori Geary, who has taken her leave a while ago now from WSB-TV, where she was, I think it's safe to say, the best political reporter in the media. And now is running her own company.
Yeah, Lori Geary Media. It's just fun to be in the private sector and kind of setting my own hours and spending time with the kids.
What's amazing about you is that you have kept your hand in. There is not much you miss. When you've come on the show, even since you've been gone, you are on top of everything we talk about. It's an addiction, right? That's exactly right. And we're glad to welcome back the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party, Michael Owens, who's become a real regular on the show, and we're glad about that. He's also one of the country's leading experts on cybersecurity. Michael, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, of course. I'm always happy to be here.
All right. You know, we often try on Political Rewind to open with news about Georgia, local news. Today, though, our whole team realized there's simply no way we can escape beginning the conversation with what's going on with the Trump White House in the aftermath of Donald Trump Jr.'s tweets and the emails that have been uncovered. So we're going to get into that. I was thinking that we ought to start by talking about how this has unfolded from the White House point of view. As recently as 2 days ago, I think I'm right about this, or was it? It may have been yesterday. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, in an off-camera briefing, was asked over, and I guess it was just yesterday, asked over and over and over again about whether or not they were going to comment on Donald Trump Jr.'s taking a meeting with a woman purportedly a functionary of the Russian government. And let's listen to what she said just yesterday.
I have a quick statement that I'll read from the president. My son is a high quality person, and I applaud his transparency. And beyond that, I'm going to have to refer everything on this matter to John Jr.'s counsel and outside counsel, and won't have anything else to add beyond that today.
She was asked, she had to repeat that over and over again because that was all that anybody at the briefing wanted to ask her. Greg, let me start with you on this. Because things changed over the next 24 hours. But what I found striking about that as a starting point is that either Sean Spicer or Sarah Sanders have been so defensive, have been so pugnacious in wanting to argue back with reporters about everything that involves any hint of scandal with the Trump administration. And I was struck by the fact that not only was this a non-statement, but it wasn't an argumentative non-statement. It was a whole different tone.
No, because they kind of knew they couldn't cast this as fake news when the emails, the goods, the goods were out there. The New York Times had the goods on Donald Trump Jr. and went so far as to alert him, saying we're about to report this like any reporter would do, and he leaked his own emails out before they could report it. And now the other byword we're hearing from a lot of the Trump and his allies are how transparent Donald Trump Jr. has been about this, even though it took several days of New York Times stories to get to this point.
Yeah, Rusty, the other, of course, thing that's happened is that the president did leave it at one statement yesterday afternoon. And there was a lot of reaction to that from people saying, well, maybe the president's lawyers have convinced him that he has to be quiet. That didn't last very long. Last night, his son appeared on Sean Hannity's show on Fox News, and the president decided to start tweeting. My son Donald did a good job last night. This was early this morning. And then he went on to say he was open, transparent, and innocent. This is the greatest witch hunt in political history. Sad. Then he tweeted, remember when you hear the word sources say from the fake media, oftentimes those sources are made up and do not exist. And he retweeted a Fox News message quoting one of the network's commentators saying, I believe Don is the victim here. The problem with all this is that instead of being transparent from the start, the story from Don Trump Jr. has evolved.
Well, here's if you're advising any candidate and you have a problem of this type, you want to get it over with as soon as possible. You go in and say, get every document there is about this issue, get them together, let's put them together, make sure you leave nothing out, and get it out there and get this over with. It's the slow bleeding, the death by a thousand cuts, which kills you in a political contest. And, you know, it's tragic to watch. I hate to see it within my own party, but if they were asking me now whether, you know, this is one of the challenges, does the principal ever, he's probably getting advice, but do they follow it? They make the, you know, you always hear, well, the staff shouldn't have let him done that. The principal always makes the final decision.
Well, you know, what I thought, Lori and Michael, both of you, please feel free to weigh in on this. I thought the Washington Post had a rather astonishing story this morning, because the Post reported that the first statement that Don Jr. made, which was, well, the meeting, we didn't know who this woman was, and she ended up wanting to talk about issues surrounding abortion and adoption and sanctions. And it turns out the Post was able to report that that statement was crafted on Air Force One, flying back from the G20, and it was crafted by the, not specific names, but top advisors to the president, and he signed off on it. It was a misleading statement, and the president signed off on it.
Well, this has been the problem all along. I mean, you talk about the worst enemy when it comes to communication. They're their own worst enemy. And this story, when you talk about evolving, Bill, it has evolved from this, oh, it was a meeting about adoption, to it was going to be opposition research and, quote, love it from Donald Trump Jr. So he knew full well that what this meeting was intended to be, whether it was or not, but also that the fact that he brought in Jared Kushner
and Paul Manafort,
the campaign manager, he knew that this was something. And the problem is, when you want to talk about transparency, why weren't you transparent from the beginning about this meeting, that you knew all of this stuff was going to come out? Everybody and their brother is digging about the Russian investigation. So if there are other meetings out there, the best advice to give them is make sure they're all on the table now.
Yeah, you know, it strikes me, Michael, that for a long time, I think Republicans and certainly the White House was able to say with some justification, nobody's shown any proof whatsoever of any possible collusion.
Right.
This is a fake story. It's being fanned. The flames are being fanned by a hostile media, which, by the way, I think there's some truth to, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Nevertheless, all of a sudden, this changes everything.
Sure. Well, I mean, you cannot continue to be in the oblivious and just continue to deny and deny. I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire sooner or later. And you know, this is just a story that will not go away. And the further we go along, right, the more it evolves. And we find more actors that were involved and more people that was involved. And the idea that you just keep saying no, like it's going to go away, is not going to make it go away. So you start to dabble the truth out bit by bit. And, you know, as Rusty said, it just makes it worse over time, right? And part of the key thing about this was, as you said, Lori, there was a clear impetus and a reason as to why this meeting was going to happen, right? And then to say later on, oh, well, it turned into nothing. She didn't have any information. It's not the fact that she didn't have any information. It was the fact that you actually went there to get that information.
Well, and thinking about this from having been inside not the, well, the White House, but in a cabinet agency, what happens in these situations is it saps all the energy out of the institution. You can't focus on your policy goals because you've got the chief of staff and the general counsel and all these other folks in a room trying to figure out how to deal with these media crises. And in the meantime, nothing is getting done. I talked to a friend of mine in Washington this week, who well connected. And he was complaining about the fact that nothing is happening, and he was, and this is a Republican, upset with Paul Ryan as he was with the White House because nothing is getting done, and said something that I found astonishing. They were wishing that Newt Gingrich was back in town.
And you're right, those policy goals are already on the ropes, yeah. And it brings me back to something that John McCain has been saying over and over again, but he said it again yesterday, the other shoe is still yet to drop.
So I want to play something for you. We introduced you last week to Jared Yates Sexton, who you'll recall came on the show because he was the guy down in South Georgia. He's a professor at Georgia Southern University, who is an investigative journalist, and he was able to identify the guy who made that GIF, which shows President Trump beating up CNN, and it was Jared who was able to also show the kind of racist tweets, the misogynistic tweets that he had put out, posts on Reddit, which is a social media site for those of you like me who don't pay much attention to it. Well, it turns out that Jared is back in the news. Last night, he made the Stephen Colbert Show, and we thought we should play you what Colbert had to say, and then we have a little conversation with Jared we want to share with you.
You know who else couldn't believe that Don Jr. published these emails this morning? The journalists who've been trying to dig them up for months. One reporter tweeted, "I worked on this story for a year," and he tweeted it out. I spent hours and days and weeks and months, and his son just hit tweet. I tracked down sources. I followed so many dead leads. I labored over this, and then he just, you know, tweeted out the proof.
Well, Jared Yates Sexton, you're the journalist who Stephen Colbert was talking about last night. Quite a tweet storm.
It's been quite a couple of days.
You began more than a year ago hoping that you could find a smoking gun in terms of the more general story, a Russian connection to the Trump campaign, not specifically thinking you were going to find a meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a possible Russian agent.
That's right. I've been investigating, trying to find proof that there is collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And again, it was one of the more surprising things for it to just be offered up by one of the principals. This has been such an odd arc of a story. It started out in the beginning as sort of a conspiratorial rumor, and anybody who wanted to follow the trail of it was labeled as a paranoid conspiracy.
Let me make sure I understand. When you say a conspiratorial rumor, you're talking again about the broader question of whether there was collusion between the campaign and Russia, not the meeting itself. Okay, go ahead.
That's right. The actual Trump collusion story started circulating in late July, right around the Democratic National Convention when the DNC emails were leaked. And so in the very beginning, it was a thing where it was very clandestine. It was very deep throat, trying to find people who would go on the record for this thing. And people were frightened. People were nervous about going on the record. And so you got a lot of background. You got a lot of people who were more than happy to talk about what they had heard and how this thing was shaped. But it was incredibly frustrating because you would get led one way or another over the course of a year. And it felt like, you know, this was a story that was never going to reach fruition because it was so large and unwieldy. And then it was just tied up in a tidy little package by the son of the president.
As an independent journalist, how does it feel to be scooped not by another journalist, but by a participant in the events himself?
Well, most of the time when you're working on a story and somebody else gets it, you know, you send a congratulatory email. But with Donald Trump Jr., it doesn't feel necessary at this point. I mean, it's more of a confession. And it's also one of those weird things where, you know, it's obvious now that he doesn't feel as if he's done anything wrong. He is now spinning the story to say that it's not proof of collusion, that it's not any type of a smoking gun. So it's very odd to see the proof that you've been looking for so long now being spun as some sort of nothing. This is the craziest thing because, you know, you turn on the TV last night and Donald Trump Jr. is on TV being interviewed by Sean Hannity, which is a bizarre thing when he shouldn't be saying anything. And then immediately following his segment is a Trump lawyer. And what's actually happening is a lot of these old legal norms, which is stay quiet until there's a strategy, are completely being overturned. So what?
That's we're gonna. Jared gave us a lot more. Maybe we can post the rest of that on the website. But I wanted to give you a chance to hear from Jared Yates Sexton. Before we take a break, I want to give everybody a shot at this. Where is this headed? Are we now on the verge? Well, let me say this first, and I want to go to you first, if I can, Rusty, because you're the Republican at the table. The media. I mean, there is obviously a real news story here. But I turn on Fox News, and even some of the Fox News folks are saying this is bad. But I turn on MSNBC, and they have they're already talking, some of their people, this is treason. This is a criminal. He'll be criminally prosecuted. There are times when the media strikes me, Rusty, as getting so far ahead of the story. And as we've said on this show before, instead of taking a deep breath, reporting what we know, and then letting the story unfold. But the question is, where is this headed?
I have no idea where it's headed. Only the principals know. But I can tell you that there are serious problems that we face in this country that are not getting the necessary attention because of this. And that's the thing, as a policymaker, that disturbs me. Not only is it consuming so much of the oxygen out of the White House that nothing is getting done because staff is sitting around talking about it and there are people trying to work to put their fingers in the dike, there's just an awful lot of things that really need to be done, that need to be discussed, that real problems that need to be solved that aren't getting done. And that's the real tragedy of all of this. And the media has responsibility. They don't tell us what to think, but they do tell us what to think about. And that's an important role that they play. And the fact that they're not encouraging us to think about these major problems, I think, is a real dereliction of duty by the news media.
I can agree with Rusty on that point that there's a lot of things within the White House administration that just haven't been happening, right? You can talk about the Senate confirmations or lack thereof, even from the president of actually
or
putting
even
people
nominations
out there, right?
Of people,
or nominations,
yeah.
Right? Never mind confirmations, people. But yeah. Just nominating people. And so there's a lot that should be happening that's not happening. But at the same time, this issue goes to the heart of American democracy, right? It goes from the beginning to the actual campaign season itself. So to question that, right, we have to take a critical look at it, right? And we cannot trivialize this under the guise of partisan politics, because it's not, right? This is a matter of national security, and it should be fully investigated.
And I agree with the investigative part of it, and who knows what that will lead to. But in terms of the court of public opinion, Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr., President Trump, they're losing it because they've not handled this the way that they need to. This is a clear crisis communications 101 way to handle something, and they're not doing it. And they need to come forward. I mean, it goes down to what Jared had mentioned. There's no such thing anymore as no comment. There's just not. Because of the age of social media, because it's a 24-hour news cycle, and if you're going to come out and say no comment, it's not going to help your case.
But Trump has gotten away with this. The president has gotten away with this all throughout the campaign season, right? When how many times did we all think he was sunk and his campaign was over with? So he's continued to get away with things we felt that would knock anyone.
Well, that's right. And Greg, part of it is that he's at 85% approval in the Republican Party, mm-hmm. according
and
to most of the late polls.
And is anyone talking about what he said about the Scarborough Morning Joe last week? That was the big news of, sure. of late last. No. And you know, who knows what next week will bring. But what I'm pretty certain of is, I mean, Donald Trump Jr. said it last night, he will cooperate with federal investigators. He will probably be called before Mueller's panel to talk about this. This is not going away. And there will be lots more speculation about whether or not he did cross a legal barrier. And the best assessment I saw was from two bipartisan Washington lawyers who are both former federal prosecutors who wrote, the investigation has much further to go before Trump's junior's liability or that of others can finally be assessed, but it could get to that point where they figured out that he has crossed that line.
All right, we got to take a break, and we have so much more to talk about. But as we do, I do think one of the great comments that I heard in the last 24 hours was from a Republican on the Hill, Trey Gowdy, who, of course, has never been much of a fan of the Democratic Party, certainly not of Hillary Clinton. And Trey Gowdy told one news organization, it's time for them to come clean. Everybody in the White House needs to report on from the first time they saw Dr. Zhivago all the way until they had a shot of vodka with Boris. When Trey Gowdy is telling you that, you know the White House has got to take this seriously. All right, we got a lot to talk about. Chris Ray is on the Hill today, an Atlanta lawyer and former Justice Department official who is in his confirmation hearings right now. David Perdue has had great success. The Senate staying in session into August and to work on issues, and Perdue is a big reason why. So we'll talk about all that and more after the break.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, actor and comic Kumail Nanjiani and comedy writer Emily V. Gordon, they co-wrote and he stars in the new romantic comedy The Big Sick. It's based on how they met and later got married after she was placed in a medically induced coma. Nanjiani grew up in Pakistan, and in the film, his parents want him to have a traditional arranged marriage. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Rush Paul, Mayor of Sandy Springs, Lori Geary, former political reporter for WSB-TV, Michael Owens, the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party, and Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Christopher Ray, Greg, is on the Hill right now, facing what have been so far, I watched it throughout the morning, fairly easygoing questioning by both Senate Democrats and Republicans on the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, he has some bipartisan credentials. And, of course, as you mentioned earlier, he has very deep roots in Atlanta, worked for King and Spalding. His wife's family, one of the patriarchs, used to own the Atlanta Constitution. So they're about as old Atlanta as you can get. But it's expected. He's being asked about Russia. He's been asked about conflicts of interest and how he'd run the office. But he's expected to kind of breeze through this.
He was introduced by our own Sam Nunn. Let's listen to just a little of what Nunn told the committee.
Chris Ray possesses an unwavering commitment to the rule of law. He has a proven track record of following the facts and the law, independent of favor or influence. Chris understands that the FBI and the Department of Justice owe loyalty to the Constitution, our laws, and our nation, and not to any particular office holder. He has demonstrated his commitment that these fundamental principles be upheld at the Department of Justice.
Lori, of course, his comments were measured and pointed. He was addressing the fact that we, of course, know that Jim Comey was fired, presumably because he wouldn't march in lockstep with President Trump. Sally Yates was fired because she wasn't able to work with the president. So Sam Nunn made the point.
And I think Chris Ray also made the point in his comments that he understands this is a very critical, a very crucial time for somebody to take over this role. And I think his comments and his lines of his answers to a lot of the questions were very pointed, just like his introduction.
Yeah, he did two things, two headlines that came out of this. He contradicted Trump in the sense that when asked, he said, no, this investigation of Russia, possible collusion is not a witch hunt. He also said, I would not meet alone in the White House anywhere with the president of the United States. And he said if he was asked to do anything illegal by the White House, he would resign. Let's just listen to a couple of his remarks.
I believe to my core that there's only one right way to do this job, and that is with strict independence, by the book, playing it straight, faithful to the Constitution faithful to our laws and faithful to the best practices of the institution. Without fear, without favoritism, and certainly without regard to any partisan political influence. And I would just say, anybody who thinks that I would be pulling punches as the FBI director sure doesn't know me very well.
This is a guy who's not going to have any trouble getting confirmed, is he, Rusty?
No, we talked about the White House problems with, but somebody was very smart in the White House who manages at least this particular nomination by dragging out Senator Nunn. Normally, the tradition is you have one of your sitting senators. That would be either Senator Perdue or Senator Isaacson, by bringing out probably the most revered Democrat on both sides of the aisle to do this introduction. There was some dental work done in extracting the fangs.
By the way, Sam Nunn will be a guest live on our show on Monday to talk about North Korea, about Russia, and we'll ask him maybe a little bit about how he feels about Chris Wray's role trying to work in the Justice Department with Donald Trump as president. What do you think about that, Michael? I mean, how does it is somewhat ironic that on the same day that the Russia collusion story seems to have, for the first time, some real serious possibilities of being true, here's Christopher Wray having a hearing about being FBI director. It's odd timing, and I don't know why you want to be the FBI director under Donald Trump.
I don't know why you want to work for any cabinet position in Donald Trump, right? I mean, you laid it out earlier, and it would be scaring. Right? You're talking about walking on eggshells, right? So it would be constantly that. But I think this has to scream bipartisanship, right? To say standing up to Donald Trump is something that, whether side you're on the aisle, it is going to have to be paramount, right? And whoever is going to do that going to have to be able to stand up in front of Senate confirmation and say, yeah, I will, and have everyone believe him, everyone in the room believe him. I don't think it's just a matter of fact now of getting Democrats to believe that. Republicans have to believe that as well now.
It seems to me, in a way, Laurie, it's a cynical thing for me to ask, why would you want to be FBI director with Trump as president? Because the reality is, I mean, Ray was making, and I think I read this in Greg Bluestein's Atlanta Political Insider blog, he was making a lot
of
money.
Partner.
He's a partner at King & Spalding. You're making a ton of dough there. But despite all the cynicism in the air, public service still matters to people.
It does. And it really, at this point in time, it's the ultimate challenge. I mean, if you can get in there and turn the FBI around in this reputation that they have right now, you have a legacy. And, you've done what you can in the private sector. He's very successful. He's got a great reputation. What's next? And there is, and Rusty, you know this, there is this tug at the heart about public service. And we see this in the politicians who might get kicked down time and time again, but continue to try to get up.
Well, here's an example sitting right here in our studio.
What is it, Rusty?
I have a disease that they occasionally put into remission, but they haven't found a cure for yet.
40 years, right, Rusty?
40 years. 40 years.
That, by the way, let's not let that just go. You said that to us before the show started. You were in your 40th year of public service.
Right.
You don't look it.
Why?
Well, thank you. I just qualified for Medicare last month.
No, congratulations.
Thank you.
Welcome to the club. Greg, any final comments about Christopher Wray? He's an upstanding guy, obviously.
Well, on the Wray thing, I mean, this ideally, this post should be as nonpartisan, as independent as you can get. So it's not one of those where he's sacrificing any of, if he's a liberal or conservative, or whatever he might be. It should be as nonpartisan. It should be as, extracted from the political debate as could be. But as we've seen with some Comey issues, sometimes it's not.
Okay, let's move on. A week or so ago, junior senator David Perdue of Georgia started his he's talked about it in the past, but he really pushed it even harder this time, saying we should not take an August recess. We have health care to do. We have a budget to get to. We have the debt ceiling to address. And it seemed like a lone wolf sort of campaign on David Perdue's part. And yesterday, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, we're going to work through the first 2 weeks of our recess. Perdue was part of a news conference yesterday responding to what McConnell said.
Between now and the end of the fiscal year, we only have 31 working days left. And we have the debt ceiling to get through, the budget for 2018, the reconciliation that goes with that, and the appropriation process to fund the government before September 30th. And then, even if all that were to get done, we've got tax, which is the last thing in the president's agenda that we want to get to this year. And we just want to make sure that we have plenty of time to get all that done.
During that news conference, a reporter asked whether or not this was just a way to avoid town meetings back home. Talk about cynical. And I thought he was rightly called out by the senators in that news conference. Here's what Perdue said.
Everybody on this stage goes home every weekend. We're talking to our constituents every day here in Washington, every day when we're back home. That's not the purpose of this at all. There's only one purpose, and that's to get the results of people back home who we are talking to or asking us to get.
Lori, it strikes. Go ahead.
I think as somebody who covered Senator Perdue from the beginning when he announced his campaign, I think you can tell from his subsequent interviews that he's always been so frustrated with the pace of Washington, and it's probably at the height right now. And I could just see him and saying, like, we have to do this.
The thing that gets me, though, is David Perdue was also one of the early supporters of Donald Trump, right? And he says, you know, hey, you know, we have the Oval Office, we have the Senate, we have the Congress. Why can't we get anything done? People need to focus on things they really need to. And they do. But your president is the main reason that they're not, right? He's a huge detractor, we mentioned earlier, right, to actually getting things done. So it's strange to me that I understand he's frustrated, but he won't call out the president in any kind of way, right, for causing so much of the delays that's actually happening.
So I want to ask a question about that. McConnell and other Republicans in the Senate have been criticized a bit for not calling out Trump on some of the shenanigans, to use a mild euphemism. But I got to wonder, Rusty, how do we have it both ways? I mean, you've got to work on an agenda on the Hill without regard to what the president's doing. I wonder about that criticism.
Well, first of all, why don't the Republicans go after the president? You stated it in the very beginning, early on, when you said 85% of the Republican base still supports the president of the United States, Donald Trump. So do you want to, you know, which do you fear most, a general election fight or a primary fight and a general election fight? So first of all, you don't want to upset your base. Those are the folks that you've got to have to stay with you. And no party wants to throw its number one, the titular head, the leader of the party, overboard. They hope springs eternal. You hope things will get better, that there will be change that will allow things to be different. And so there's a variety of factors that keep the party together. Whether they like it or not, it's kind of like a Catholic divorce. They just don't happen, you know?
And I think also the message from the Senate was, look, despite what the shenanigans happening over in the White House, we're still working. We're still going to try to get our jobs done. You know, we're going to focus on health care, on tax reform. We're going to focus on the debt ceiling. And he ticked off the things.
I wonder if there's a trap here, though, Greg. McConnell says he's going to add 2 weeks to the calendar, work calendar, to get health care done. And there's absolutely no sign whatsoever that they're going to be able to get anything done on health care with all of the problems they're facing.
No, and the new bill isn't even out yet. We haven't seen it at all. We're already hearing even stalwart administration supporters. I mean, I guess I wouldn't call Johnny Isaacson a stalwart, but he's been generally positive about the GOP agenda. Even he, last night in his telephone town hall meeting, threw a little shade at the secretive process the Republicans are going about the health care bill. And we just saw Trump send a preemptive tweet just a few minutes ago about the upcoming CBO analysis, saying that it's going to be wrong.
Yeah, let's point out that there is a new bill. McConnell is expected to unveil it tomorrow. We have no way of knowing whether they're finding a way to accommodate both their conservative and more moderate members, but they're going to try. And that's the CBO score that Greg says that the president was tweeting about, the one that will refer to the bill tomorrow.
Right. And that's exactly why Mitch McConnell wanted this vote to be so quick, because the longer it's taken, the more defectors he's had. Now you're seeing defectors in Kansas and the Dakotas and moderates in Maine and conservatives in Kentucky, and you're losing people left and right. And at this point, there's very little optimism that something can get passed.
Well, the biggest thing I'm seeing now is Senator Lindsey Graham, right, saying that, oh, you guys can't do this? Well, I think I have a fundamentally different approach to this that we can actually do to make this work. And oh, by the way, I think we got some bipartisan support to actually make this happen, right? So then McConnell's like, oh, yeah, let's do this recess thing.
Thank you, because you just set up a soundbite from Mitch McConnell that I want to play. Yesterday, when he held his news conference announcing they're going to extend into August to work, he said this about why they haven't gotten any of their agenda passed.
Also, due to this unprecedented level of obstruction that we've been experiencing, we will be in session the first 2 weeks of August that we had originally anticipated not being here. We will be here. We've got defense authorization. We've got the debt ceiling. We've got the FDA user fee and other important legislation that we need to address, and we simply, as a result of all this obstructionism, don't have enough time to address all of these issues between now and the originally anticipated August recess. So we'll be here the first 2 weeks of August.
Majority Leader McConnell-Laurie, this is the man who made a statement, which I said on the show a couple weeks ago, kind of startled me. He said that if we don't get Republicans together on health care, we're going to be, quote, forced to work with Democrats. A bipartisan approach. He considered that to be a threat, and now he accuses the Democrats of obstructionism.
What an anomaly. Actually, Democrats and Republicans working together. And I know we're getting to that segment with Johnny Isaacson, but here's the problem is that, you know, if McConnell can appease the senators, Ted Cruz and his crew, then you lose the moderates. So is there any way of coming together on health care?
Mitch McConnell has the worst job in Washington. In any legislative environment where
I'm sorry. Sean Spicer bad?
No, even worse. Even worse. Because when you in a legislative environment where you have a one or two vote majority, any one or two people can derail the operation. And he's got it on both ends. And, I don't think it's a threat. I think that it's a real possibility because the healthcare system is broken. Premiums are up. Deductibles are up. The insurance industry's collapsing. He's right when he says we've got to fix these things. And I think he's going to go about trying to at least fix those things that have to be fixed with whatever votes he can get.
Rusty, you were up there with Jack Kemp. Mm-hmm. We talked about that. I can't remember. Were you there when he was a congressman? Did you start with him in those days, or was it HUD?
Well, I started working with him while he was still a congressman, but I was here, not in D.C. It was after he got to HUD.
My point is, there was a guy who was a conservative, mm-hmm. bedrock conservative, but Jack Kemp always was open to hearing other voices and to working across party lines. He was a really remarkable guy in that way.
There was nobody who enjoyed persuading his adversaries that he was right than Jack Kemp. But he had an aphorism, which I've repeated here before, that is lost in American politics today. You serve your party best by serving your country first. And you serve your country first by dealing with the real problems. There's plenty of stuff for us to disagree about, but go figure out the big things and work it out. Used to, somebody would put a bottle of blackjack in the middle of a table and everybody would come around and when the bottle was empty, they had a solution that had some bipartisan overtones.
All right, we got to get a break. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I've got to do that. But before I do, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Sam Burnham has. He says, we hear this is it, the smoking gun, every 2 weeks until the story dies and another emerges. Give this 2 weeks. Fair. Mm-hmm. Fair. Prima Donna, who says, so zillions of Benghazi hearings were necessary, but to investigate collusion with Russia is taking the oxygen out of the air, right? John Stoge writes, he says to you, Rusty Paul, and thank you for your service to Sandy Springs, Mr. Mayor. Rusty's brother-in-law listening to the show. And Barbara S. says, Senator Perdue wants a couple more weeks in D.C. because he's scared to come home and face the music. I get voicemail every time I call his office. I would suggest the other side of that. He, like every other Republican in the Senate, would be even more afraid to come home at the end of August if they haven't done something up there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about Johnny Isaacson, as Lori Geary said a moment ago. He's been in the news in a very positive way.
I'm Jan Bond. I'm the Associate Vice President for Marketing and Communications at Georgia Southern University. Georgia Southern is a public university in the state of Georgia. We are a comprehensive research institution with 20,600 students. We know that the listeners at Georgia Public Radio value its sponsors and underwriters because they know that we're not just advertisers, but supporters of Georgia Public Radio and the value it brings to their lives.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Austin, Texas is booming, and as its neighborhoods change, many black residents are being pushed out.
I was a part of the community. It doesn't really exist anymore as it did. And that's pretty sad for me.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Why Austin's black residents are leaving and where they're going, plus the latest on Trump and Russia, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear All Things Considered from 4 till 7 this afternoon on GPB.
Welcome back, Greg Bluestein, Lori Geary, Michael Owens, and Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs are here. I said, before we close, we're going to get to the fundraising totals of the gubernatorial candidates here. But before we do, I mentioned Johnny Isaacson. The New York Times did a piece on Johnny Isaacson, Lori, this week, saying of all the people in Washington, this is the man whose committee works across party lines and actually gets something done. They're talking about his chairmanship of the Veteran Affairs Committee.
Right. So I think we need Senator Isaacson to chair a few more committees.
He's got two.
I know.
He's the only chairman with two.
He is. And there's probably a reason for that. But Senator Isaacson is doing what he's done here in Georgia for quite a long time, which is work across the lines. I mean, he gets bipartisan support every time he's up for re-election. And I think, you know, if we could just take a lesson from his playbook on how he does this. He's always respectful and he always listens to the other side.
And it's exactly why he didn't draw even a prominent Democratic challenger last year for a new 6-year term. I mean, no one would raise their hand against them.
Yeah, right. Michael Owens, chairman of the Cobb Democratic Party, is shaking his head. How do I have this guy in my own county?
I'm not shaking my head. I mean, we did have a candidate to run against him, but you know, yeah, Senator Isaacson drew some very good support from some prominent Democrats. So, and I think this is also an area where, you know, as a Marine Corps veteran myself, you know, I have to say that veterans' issues is one of the things we almost always have to rise above partisan politics,
yes.
Right? I mean, we're talking national security. We're talking about 21 million veterans at a time where, you know, we've sustained some of the largest, longest wartime effort in American history. So, which also means there's a lot of veterans back home, you know, here in, you know, or down the road in Cobb County, of course, but all over the country. So everyone that's on this committee, right, has a real role in making sure stuff gets done. And things they have gotten done, you know, when they got Shulkin as unanimous confirmation, right? I think that's the only one that's been thus far, right? And some of the other bills that they've gotten through thus far have been really good, trying to get down the wait lines, right? Trying to make sure that veterans can go to outside facilities so they can get care faster. So the things they've done has also been substantive stuff, right? So hats off to Senator Isaacson for it. But even more importantly, we're putting national politics or national needs above partisanship.
Okay, I want to do one more thing about Isaacson and then move on to the governor's fundraising totals. Greg, you mentioned that Johnny Isaacson had a telephone town meeting and talked about, obviously, a variety of things. But one of the things he was asked about was why he isn't more critical of the Trump administration, why he hasn't more publicly spoken out. And in fact, his answer was interesting because he responded to the attack ad that a pro-Trump PAC put out going after Dean Heller, Senator Heller in Nevada, who was opposing the health care bill. And here's what Isaacson said about that.
Most recently, 2 weeks ago, at a luncheon in the Mansfield Room in the Senate wing of the United States Capitol, I questioned the vice president as to why they were using a certain type of advertising they were used against one of our, Dean Heller, one of our members who's up for re-election in Nevada, on the health care issue. I didn't think people in the administration ought to be running ads one way or another against an elected official to try and force them towards a position one way or another. So there are many other occasions of that, and I try to do it on a selective basis, but when it really means something.
All right, there's Johnny Isaacson. Let's move on, because we only got a couple minutes. Greg, we've now seen fundraising figures from all the candidates, Republican and Democrat, for governor. What strikes you about, first of all, the GOP figures?
Yeah, and this was a big test for the gubernatorial candidates, especially for Casey Cagle. There's a lot of people still on the sidelines watching those numbers, seeing whether or not there's an opening for them to get in, especially if Casey Cagle didn't put up a big number, and he put up nearly $3 million, which is a big number for this early in the race for an open contest. And immediately I started hearing from a lot of people on those sidelines saying, wow, he's going to be really tough to beat. This really cemented, we already knew he was the front runner, but this really cemented that status.
Does it?
Well, probably. I don't think this. He definitely wasn't harmed by the fact that he was the fundraising leader. Brian Kemp raised some decent numbers. But
1-7, not right, bad.
But the interesting thing was, the last time I was here, it was just before the Handel Ossoff runoff. And I said that if the Democrats didn't win this race, they were going to have a tough time raising money. And the real contrast between the Democratic candidates and the Republican candidates, how much they took in, I think reflects the fact that they bet the house, the farm, and a couple of kids on that race, and it's making it difficult for those Democratic candidates now to raise money.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because you had Kemp at just almost 3. Cagle, you had Kemp at almost 2, and Michael Williams, although he put a ton of his own money in.
$1 million.
At a million for a guy who's really unknown around the state. And then, Laura, you've got Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidates, coming in at $500,000. And that's been my question, and to some extent, Rusty answered it. Are Democrats going to struggle to raise big dollars? Or is it partly what Rusty's saying? Is it also because when you're lieutenant governor or secretary of state, you're in much more powerful positions to get those contributions? What do you attribute this to?
Well, last time I was on the show, it was right before we knew the results of the Ossoff-Handel election. And I said, if Ossoff had won, look out, the Democrats are going to be pouring money into the state. So I think there is that effect that, you know, we couldn't take her down. We couldn't take Karen Handel down. So I think it will be hard for Democrats to raise some money. But on the other hand, it did show that maybe Georgia and some counties like Gwinnett and Cobb were turning more purple, right? We've seen that this last election go around. So I'm not sure if it'll be, I mean, they're not going to raise probably as much money as Republicans, but I think that both of these candidates, Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams, are both formidable candidates.
Does this worry you, Michael?
It doesn't really worry me. I think, there was obviously a lot of the talk about the Stacey's getting in the race, but they got in, you know, it hasn't been too long since they got in the race. Particularly Stacey Evans has gotten in the race and raised a large sum of money in a short amount of time. But I also think part of this is we have two fantastic candidates and Democrats that are running who both have strong followings, who are both top Democrats in the House Minority Caucus. And I quite honestly think some folks are waiting to see how this shakes out a little bit to see if there's one clear front runner before people really start putting their money in either way.
But I think you could say that for the Republicans, too. And I also think that, you know, if you look back, we had at this point, John Oxendine was the front runner 8 years ago. So you really got to, money isn't everything, which we've seen. But also, you know, if you come out this far ahead right now, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be ahead when it counts.
It's funny, Oxendine was the front runner, but Casey Cagle was actually the leading money getter because he had not yet dropped out of the race from both sides. And when we did an analysis that will be out in Sunday's paper, but the establishment, the PACs, they have gone in big for Casey Cagle, no surprise there. And David Schaefer, lieutenant governor, who almost raised $1 million in that race, which is an eye-popping number. Democrats, I can say this, that Stacey Evans people were just thrilled with the fact that Stacey Abrams managed to only raise about $500,000. They thought with her national profile, with about 2 months, basically a month longer than Stacey Evans had in the race, that she'd be at least 7 figures. They were thinking maybe even as high as $2 million, and she ends up raising roughly.
I would have thought that too, Michael, Rusty.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that she has national prominence, right? You can say she's been on a national stage. It did show in the fundraising a little bit because a little over half her money, right,
her
was
money
from out of state. So that definitely is attributable to her national perspective.
And it always comes down to how hard a candidate's willing to work. Any candidate that tells you they like raising money will lie to you about other things. And so, you don't know how hard the candidate is because nobody wants to sit down and make those phone calls. Yeah. And you always find reasons not to. Sometimes it takes a report like this to jar a candidate into real activity. So we'll see how it plays out.
And let me say this, too. I don't think that John Ossoff money is gone, right? Georgia has firmly planted itself on the national map as purple battleground state or whatever you want to call it. So I think as soon as there's a hint that this is truly in play, I think that, you know, a lot of that money will come back, especially from the small voters around the country.
Just to be a contrarian, has it, Lori? You know, this is 2017, 2014. Jason Carter, who's on the show Friday, and Michelle Nunn, we thought they were going to go somewhere as Democratic candidate. Didn't happen. 2016, John Ossoff doesn't go anywhere. Are the Democrats really on the rise here?
I don't know. I think I've heard that since I took over political reporter from you 14 years ago.
Yeah, but back then, the Republicans were in charge by the time I left.
They didn't have the control of the House. But I don't know. When you see counties like Cobb and Gwinnett turning a little bit, I think it does put Georgia a little bit more in play. I'm not going to say it's a battleground state, but I think, you know, you can't change the shift of the demographics. They are shifting. The Republican Party needs to know this. They need to get a hold of that.
Let me bring you a little history. In 1976, Jimmy Carter won with the evangelical vote. 4 years later, Ronald Reagan took that. Demographics is the weakest foundation upon which you can build your party loyalty. The Democrats are waiting for the demographics of this state to change, and they are changing. But what they miss is a message that connects to the average Georgia resident. That's what's missing. It's not about who grows up and starts voting. It's what kind of message do you have that will appeal to these folks so that those who are looking for solutions can buy into it.
I think that's a really interesting point. And we've got very little time, but I'm going to throw this out. Isn't that one of the reasons that people like Roy Barnes and a number of other Democrats are putting their bets on Stacey Evans? Because they think she may have, having grown up poor, being a big proponent of keeping hope alive, I mean the Hope Scholarship, that she might have the kind of message that Rusty says Democrats need.
Yeah, and that's exactly why Stacey Abrams' answer to that is it's not 1998 anymore. Mm-hmm. She's saying it's really impossible to rebuild that coalition of sort of white rural voters and,
right.
and more urban or suburban black voters.
They both have a fascinating position on this. It's going to be an exciting race to watch.
It will be.
Yeah, it will
All right.
definitely
We unfortunately are out of time for this show. I already said we should go an extra hour and stay on until 4, but Terry Gross is dying to get on the radio and talk to you with her guest today. Rusty Paul, Michael Owens, Lori Geary, Greg Bluestein, thank you so much for being here today. Before we leave you, remember, Two-Way Street is now on the air on Thursday afternoons at 2 o'clock. So we'll be with you again tomorrow. We're not talking politics. Tomorrow we're talking about the great American eclipse of 2017 on August 21st. There will be people in the United States, in South America, in Europe, and Africa will be able to watch at least a partial eclipse of the sun. And up in the Northeast Georgia Mountains, you'll be a part of a total eclipse of the sun, which is, according to our guest, David Barron, who's written a book called The American Eclipse, one of the most awe-inspiring experience you can ever have. We're going to talk to David Barron about his book. We will talk about where in North Georgia you need to be to watch the total eclipse of the sun. We recorded the show the other day, and I got to tell you, it's really an interesting conversation. So join us tomorrow at 2 for Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. We're out of time for today, but we're back on Friday with another Political Rewind at 3. So we'll see you then, if not tomorrow.